We are now enrolling for the How to Hire the Best course, Become an Employer of Choice to Attract the A Players You Want on Your Team. You can register at tapthepotential.com/course.
As it relates to friction, I think it's important to realize that friction often creates the growth that we need, one as leaders and two as a team.
Profit Designers, we have been producing the Profit by Design podcast now almost 3 years with a weekly episode. And for the first time, we are going into our vault and going back through our most popular episodes and re-releasing them. I think you're going to find a lot of value from these conversations. And I believe these are some of the most important conversations for helping you move your business forward. One of the things that you may not know is that when I record the Profit by Design podcast, I really think about our clients and our Better Business, Better Life program at Tap the Potential and what is going to serve them well in what we're supporting them in doing in creating a business that gives you time for what matters most and allows you to have more money in your bank account than ever. Every one of these episodes is chosen with that in mind. So we are on a brief hiatus at the Profit by Design podcast to allow me to get a little bit of downtime and much needed R&R in addition to some big things we're cooking up at Tap the Potential. So our team needed time to focus on the upcoming Better Business, Better Life Summit. You'll be hearing more details about that very soon. And I am working on the audible version of the 4-week vacation. So enjoy these episodes, and I will be back with you very soon. You work hard in your business. On the Profit by Design podcast, we ask the big question. What has your business done for you lately? Hi, I'm Dr. Sabrina Starling. I'm the business psychologist, the author of the 4-week vacation and the How to Hire the Best series, as well as the founder of Tap the Potential, where we coach entrepreneurs like you to design sustainably profitable businesses that give you more time for what matters most and more money in your bank account than ever. Because after all, we believe work supports life, not the other way around. Weekly on the Profit by Design podcast, we bring you tips, tools, and strategies from our own experiences and from the experiences of our guests who are entrepreneurial thought leaders and real life entrepreneurs, all to support you in making intentionally profitable and sustainable business decisions to live the lifestyle you desire. Get started on your journey with us by downloading the training so many entrepreneurs are talking about right now, how to make your time worth $10,000 an hour at tapthepotential.com/10K. Our guest is Wayne Mullins. Wayne is a passionate entrepreneur committed to creating remarkable experiences and building a team at Ugly Mug Marketing that produces extraordinary results for their clients. And I can attest to that. Tap the Potential and Profit by Design are clients of Ugly Mug Marketing. Wayne has been called the guru's guru, as he regularly is called upon for advice from Inc. 500 CEOs, New York Times bestselling authors, and Silicon Valley startups. However, his passion is helping entrepreneurs challenge their assumptions, create value from places they've never looked, and having more freedom than they've previously believed possible. He's worked hands-on with clients in over 100 different industries and from every corner of the globe. Ugly Mug Marketing, which Wayne founded 10 years ago, has won the praises of some of the leading influencers in the business world, such as Neil Patel, founder of QuickSprout and Kissmetrics, Chris Voss, New York Times bestselling author of Never Split the Difference, and Ari Weinzweig, co-founder of Zingerman's. I've learned a lot from you, Wayne, over the years. You taught a morning workshop
and you talked about context switching. And that might be something we want to get into at some point here in the conversation too. I've shared that with so many other entrepreneurs, Mike being one of them. I think I saw Mike a couple of weeks after you had done that workshop, and I had my little handout with me. I said, Mike, look at this. This is it. This is why we're crazy.
That helped me a lot. It was really helpful.
Yeah. So maybe, Wayne, do you want to share? Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah, absolutely. So let me preface our conversation today by saying that so much of what I'm going to share today, I've actually taken, I've borrowed from other people. I'm a very avid reader and learner. And so a lot of what I'm going to share are you know, answers even to questions that you may ask, more than likely are going to come from something I've read or studied somewhere. And when I can remember where, I will definitely give credit where credit is due. But regarding context switching, I learned about that from a guy named Todd Herman. And Todd teaches something called the 90-day year. And it's basically about how to get as much done in 90 days as most people get done in an entire year. And he took context switching from, and I forget the guy's name, but he was very early on in kind of computer science. And basically the premise of context switching is this, that if it's going to take you, let's say, 10 blocks of time to complete a task, what ends up happening for most business owners, most entrepreneurs, is that we start with one block of time working on this project, and then all of a sudden we have to switch to something else. So we change the context and we begin working on, let's just say, the first one that we're trying to complete in 10 blocks is a new website. And then all of a sudden, so we spend a block of time on the website, and then you know what? This fire comes up and we really need to maybe hire a new person. So we jump to another context and begin working on hiring. So then we say, okay, I really got to get back to the website. So then I jump back over to the website and spend more time on the website. And so what happens is that at the end of a month or the end of a period of time, we really haven't accomplished anything because we've spent so much time jumping back and forth. And the interesting thing about context switching is that it's not an even jump between the two. So in other words, I don't spend exactly 1 hour on this and then 1 hour on the hiring. What happens is in the middle of that context or in the middle of that switch, there's what Cal Newport would call residue. And that residue is the lag between jumping from working on the website into jumping into the hiring work. And so that residue takes time, it takes energy, it takes effort to make that, to switch between those two contexts. So that's a very rough explanation of what context switching is and why it can be so detrimental to productivity.
Yeah, that has been huge in changing how I work, Wayne. And one of the things, like, we record the podcast on Fridays. Fridays are my podcast day. That's the focus. And we get a lot done with the podcast on Fridays because of that. So very helpful. So we're here with you today to talk about how to build a high performance culture. And having interacted with your team at Ugly Mug for 4 or 5 years now, and I've gotten to work with multiple team members over this time, and they all impress me. You clearly have put a lot of time, energy, and thought into building a high performance culture. And we, on the Profit by Design podcast, we love talking to real entrepreneurs and hearing what are the things that you're doing that work. And I'm excited that we get to dive into this with you. So if you were to describe your culture at Ugly Mug, how would you sum it up?
I would sum it up kind of using a few different terms. One of them would be, and they're kind of dichotomies. So one of them would be, we do have a lot of freedom. So our team members can work kind of remotely as they see fit. Now there are parameters around that. But the flip side of that, there's high accountability that comes with that freedom. So on the one hand, they can kind of work remotely and work freely. But on the other hand to that, there are systems and processes in place to ensure that we're focusing on delivering results for our clients. So that's kind of one set of dichotomies there that I would say. The other is the need to create unique and remarkable experiences. And so that is not just in the way we treat our customers, but in the way we treat prospects and the way we treat other team members here within the company. Now, the flip side of that is we are very much a systems and processes bound company. So even though we crave creating these remarkable experiences, these things that are out of the box, or as Ron Kaufman, I believe is the last name, would say, kind of unbelievable experiences. The flip side of that is we have a lot of systems and processes that seem very rigid that enable us to create those remarkable experiences. So those would be some of the terms that I would use to kind of describe the culture here and the way we structured it.
The idea of having sound, solid systems, and that creates the foundation and the headspace even to create remarkable experience. I think that's key.
Yeah, I would agree. And what's so interesting about that is the same is true in kind of your personal life as well. And what I've noticed over the years is, you know, I'm kind of by default, I hate structure. I hate rigid. And I hate the thought of having everything, you know, planned out down to the minute. But what I've learned over the years is as I've forced myself to become more rigid with my personal schedule, and I've really worked hard to develop, you know, kind of morning rituals, evening rituals, and really structure my personal life and really scheduling things down to the minute, what has happened is I've actually found that it's much more liberating and much more freeing. And just like you said, it gives me the headspace to actually not worry about as much stuff, because I know that there's a time and a place set aside and structured to focus on whatever those things may be that I'm, you know, kind of in the back of my brain worried about.
Yeah. So in terms of creating the culture, what role do you feel like that vision, mission, and values play?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's interesting that for the longest time that I really downplayed the importance of those three things. So I would say probably for, you know, so Ugly Mug Marketing now is, we're in our 10th year in business. And I would say probably for the first five of those years, I really downplayed the importance of vision, mission, and values. I just didn't think, I thought it was more kind of this touchy-feely, you know, kind of exercise that you do. You create these sheets, you work through the things, and then you go stick them in a filing cabinet somewhere, you know, put them in a file on your computer, and you forget about them. But what I've learned over the years is that those three things, your vision, your mission, and your values, become ingrained in the culture of your business. So when you don't devote the time, energy, and effort, and you don't prioritize those three things, it directly reflects in the culture that you create. So the vision is, you know, where you're going. It's where you want to end up at some point in the future. And there's all kinds of different books and, you know, recommendations on how far out you should look. Kind of where we've settled is about a 3-year window into the future. So we're always trying to look out about 3 years into the future. And that sets the direction, the destination of where we want to get to. The mission itself is kind of, you know, from our perspective, is kind of the plan of action. It's what are we actually going to do to bring that vision to life? That's our mission. That's what drives us. That's what motivates us. And then the values are the core principles or the things that we believe in and that will stand kind of as guideposts along our path to ensure that in the pursuit of our vision, that we aren't losing our way, that we're staying true to the course that we've set out. And, you know, I know that probably most of the listeners out there have heard, you know, lots of people talk about the importance of, you know, vision, mission, and values. But what I can say is that those three things directly influence and impact the culture that you build in your company.
Yeah. And, you know, I actually thought about this podcast a lot and about culture and some of the, you know, the outline that we reviewed before we jumped on. For me, culture, you know, even just thinking about the word, you know, at different points of the business cycle where it frightened me, right? I mean, it was like another thing that I needed to think about and another thing that I needed to, you know, worry about and add into the already, you know, complex environment of owning a business. But, you know, just like you said, it is extremely important. And for the people that are trying to develop a culture that's going to help propel their business and create a better environment, do you think once the culture is developed or defined, whether organically or by design, does it kind of live and breathe on its own? or, you know, how much effort does the business owner need to continue to put into the framework of the culture moving forward to have it, you know, to make it successful. But I guess what I'm getting at, you know, I know I just said a lot of words, but what I'm getting at is, you know, so here I am, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm scared, I'm building my team. I hear all these words about culture and I need to build culture, culture, culture. And I don't want to get frustrated, right? So I want our listeners that are trying to put a better culture in place or just to, you know, work towards those goals, not to get frustrated if they're trying something and it's not working. So, you know, how much effort have you put into it? Has your culture evolved? So was there, you know, like a day one culture and now you see the evolution of it? And what can someone expect as they're now starting to really dig into this and make it part of their, you know, their day-to-day operations and just their goals and their vision?
Yeah, no, I completely understand kind of where you're coming from in the question. And what I would say is this, is that culture rises or falls with the leader. And, you know, that is something that, you know, as an entrepreneur, oftentimes we think, you know, okay, I'm going to hire these people, I'm going to hire A players, and they're going to kind of build out this culture and they're going to carry this forward. And the reality is that you, as the entrepreneur, it is solely your responsibility to ensure that the culture that you're building, that your team is building, is a reflection of what you want that to look like. And there's not a right or wrong. So, you know, the culture at Ugly Mug Marketing is different than the culture at other marketing companies around the country or even next door to us. And it's not that there's a right or a wrong answer. It's really a matter of your vision. Where do you want to end up? Where are you trying to take your company? And then ensuring that the pieces and the components that you're putting in place support and build that culture. And one of the things that can be very, very frustrating for entrepreneurs is the feeling that you constantly have to go back to square one or go back to the basics. And I don't remember where this comes from, but I've heard it said, you know, kind of several different ways. It's that basically when you get tired of saying something or reminding something to your team, they are just now starting to get it. If very early on, an entrepreneur leader I had the great fortune of coming in contact with, Ari Weinswig, he's the co-founder of Zingerman's Delicatessen up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He told me in kind of a personal conversation when we were talking about his role in the company that it was the CRO. And I was like, what's a CRO? He said the chief reminding officer. And so he viewed his role to constantly remind his leadership, remind their team where they're going, why they're going there, and why it's important. So culture, you know, for me, it's a reflection of the vision, the mission, and those values. And it's my responsibility, it's entrepreneurs' responsibility to ensure that we are aligning our team continually around those things.
You know, I want to share here that one of the things that has worked so well is the definition of immutable laws. And that's us as the entrepreneur identifying what are our core values. Because our core values are so much a part of who we are, we don't see them. We just take them for granted. But they are how we do life. And when we get frustrated with team members in our businesses, it is because they are doing life differently than us in some way. And it's a violation of one of our core values. So just the process for us as the entrepreneur to go through and identify our core values and turn those into immutable laws for the business. And immutable laws means we don't violate these here. And when we do, we seek to get back in alignment with them very quickly. And that's that process of reminding and going through, hey, this is out of whack with our immutable law. We need to address this. This can't continue. Just yesterday, I was meeting with our online business manager, and I call her our smooth operator because her job is to just go through and remove friction points internally and client-facing friction wherever. And we're putting up, you know, systems and processes in place. And this is from Josh Fonger from Work the System Way. You introduced us to him. We had him on the podcast. And they have general operating principles. So In addition to having our immutable laws at Tap the Potential, we now have general operating principles. And the immutable laws are just, you know, 3 to 5 core values and they're guiding principles. The general operating principles are a little more detailed and specific. And I was giving her, I said, I think we need to add a new operating principle. And I don't even remember what it was that we added. But as soon as I said it to her, she just paused and she breathed and she said, that feels good, just to identify that. And so I think this piece around culture and our core values and operating principles, we're putting language to things for our team members that sometimes these things have created frustration. And if we can just put words around it and identify, we're going to do this differently.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. You kind of mentioned when you were talking about that, how when a team member acts in a way that's different than the way we would act, how that leads to frustration. And often we don't even identify why that is. We just know that, you know, something going on is frustrating us or aggravating us. And like you said, we can't put words to it. And something that I've just recently come across, and it's been around for a long time, but late to the game here, is the Enneagram personality profile. And so I was just recently listening to a leadership podcast by Andy Stanley, and he had someone who wrote a book on the Enneagram personality profile on there, and they were talking through the 9 different personality traits. And what was so interesting and what really, really resonated with me is that he said that these are 9 normals. And where that really hit me is that what's normal for me is not normal for somebody else on my team. So what's normal for them, the way they would approach a project or the way they would approach, you know, handling a difficult situation with a client is different than the way that I would. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's right or wrong on either side. But if I don't want to end up frustrated by the way that things are getting handled, it's my responsibility, just like you said, to ensure that are the systems, the processes, and the documents in place that outline in detail what is normal for the culture that we are building here at our company. So it doesn't matter, you know, how you would normally approach it, and it honestly doesn't even matter how I would normally approach this. What matters is how does our culture, how does our vision, our mission, and our value say that we should approach, you know, this opportunity, this challenge, or this particular situation that we find ourselves in? And one other thing I'll just throw in there that I also picked up from another Andy Stanley leadership podcast was this: the difference between intentions and actions. And so what he talks about in one of these podcasts is that we judge ourselves based on our intentions. So I intend to, you know, start this new project. So I'm judging myself based on the fact that I intend to do it. So I give myself a good grade because my intentions are in the right place. But we judge others around us based on their actions. So where we would give ourselves kind of a pass, you know, so it's okay because I intend to do that, it's just I didn't get to it today. We judge others based on the fact, you know what, they didn't get that done today. Why didn't they get that done today? And for me, that was a very, very important kind of mental shift for me as a leader, is knowing that, you know, how if I show up late for something, there's a logical reason that I showed up late. But if someone else shows up late, a team member shows up late, you know, it's a black and white. Why were you late? There's no exception. There's no excuses, right? And so as leaders and entrepreneurs, I think that all too often, the standards that we hold for those around us, it's important that we hold ourselves to those same standards. We hold ourselves to that same benchmark for performance. And we often give ourselves a pass when it comes to that.
Yes. So how do you have that set up for yourself to avoid giving passes? How do you manage that, Wayne?
Yeah, so for myself, I remember hearing a story a long time ago from Dan Kennedy, who's kind of he's a direct response marketer and kind of, I guess in some ways, kind of the founder of direct response marketing in many aspects. But he shared a story about he was hired to come in and speak to this gentleman who owned a large group of dental practices. And Dan Kennedy, for those who don't know, only travels via private jet. So if you want him to come speak at your event or come do consulting with you, you're going to pay for his private jet to get him there. And so he flies in via private jet. He arrives at the airport, and the CEO, the dentist who originally founded these practices that have now grown into multiple locations, isn't there to pick him up like he's supposed to. And he sits and he waits and he sits and he waits, and the dentist finally shows up, and then he's got all these reasons on why he was late getting there. Well, he had hired Dan to come in and talk about the importance of doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. And so they go pull up at the office where they've got these team members from all these various locations sitting there waiting on him. And one of the things that he's supposed to talk about is doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. And they're like 20 minutes late for this event. And Dan basically gets up front and says, until the CEO, who's standing in the back of the room, who just paid him, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to come speak, is willing to do what he says he's going to do when he says he's going to do it, there's no chance that any of you sitting in this room are going to do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. And that one story, it has like burned in my brain. It's like permanently kind of engraved in my brain. And so I firmly believe in that standard for myself. And as the entrepreneur, as the owner, it's very easy from the mentality perspective to think in the back of my brain that because I have done X, Y, or Z, it's okay if I'm 5 minutes late to the meeting. And, you know, I'll give you just an easy example, a perfect example of this. One of my kind of pet peeves is showing up late for work. So kind of the general rule here is that if you're supposed to be here, for example, at 8 o'clock, that you should be ready to work at 8 o'clock. That doesn't mean you should be walking in the door at 8 o'clock. That means you should be ready to work at 8 o'clock. Well, for me, you know, I'm checking email very early in the morning. I'm checking email late in the evening. I'm handling business on the weekends. I'm doing a lot of stuff. So in the mornings, I'm supposed to be at the office at 8:15. Well, it's very easy for me to justify in the back of my brain, you know what? I checked and responded to 30 minutes worth of email this morning, you know, before 7 o'clock. So if I'm not there at 8:15, is it really that big of a deal? And the answer is yes, it is, because the culture rises and falls with the leader. And that's a very tough reality that we have to face as entrepreneurs.
Have you told that story to your employees about the intention and passes and things like that?
We have. We spend a lot of time as a team and as a culture learning. And so it's actually a requirement in our company. And we typically do that, and not always, but we typically do that through books. And so we kind of have a book club, so to speak. And so it varies based on the book, but roughly every 6 weeks or so, we're changing to a new book. And the way that it works is every team member gets a copy of the book. And then each week we assign, you know, a certain number of chapters or whatever it may be. And then every Monday in our team meeting, we discuss as a team what we read and learned over that past week. And so occasionally what we'll do from books is we'll shift, and we may listen to a series of podcasts each week. And it's kind of on your own. So it's not like we sit around and read or sit around and listen to the podcast together. They all do that individually. And then we come together in a team meeting and we discuss those things.
Have you experienced a higher level of accountability amongst your team and yourself by having that openness and learning and sharing so much with them?
Yeah, we have. We definitely have. I think the biggest benefit in terms of the learning and kind of forcing that into the culture is the growth mindset that comes out of that. And the fact that just because we're good today doesn't mean we're going to be good tomorrow. That if we're not constantly pushing ourselves and learning, that we're going to quickly be passed by other companies and other people in our industry.
So I love it when I go to my mailbox and I see a little package there from Ugly Mug, because it's going to be a good book. And one of them that Wayne sent me last summer, it is Triggers. And that is a powerful book. We've incorporated it in our coaching with our clients. I also am part of a peer mastermind group, and we've incorporated that in our accountability. And I know, Wayne, you are big on peer-to-peer accountability, and some of that comes from the book Triggers. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. Yep. So the book Triggers is written by a gentleman by the name of Marshall Goldsmith. And for those who don't know, Marshall is, I guess, was one of the most sought after kind of Fortune 100, Fortune 500 executive coaches. So he's worked with, at one point, he had worked with like 40 something percent of all the Fortune 100 CEOs. And his approach was super unique and super different. It was this: he would get asked to go coach a CEO of one of these major companies, and he would ask them to identify the one thing that they wanted to improve. And he would then say, okay, here's the way that I work. I'm going to help you improve this one thing. Unless I help you improve that one area, that one thing, you owe me nothing. But if I do help you improve this, and it's based on some measurements, and reach this, you know, goal in this specific area, then you're going to pay me. And so that was his methodology. His methodology was, you're only going to pay me if I deliver results. And those results would be measured not by the CEO's perspective or the leader's perspective, but based on the peers that surrounded the people under the CEO or the peers on the board of that CEO. That's how they measure that. So anyway, that's who Marshall is. But the book Triggers really goes into, at a very fundamental level, that it's the actions that we take every day or the actions that we don't take every day that build our lives, our businesses, and our careers. And so in Triggers, kind of the big takeaway for me, and it's so super simple, is kind of building this chain of events and not breaking the chain of events. So an example may be meditation. So maybe you have a goal to meditate every day. So the goal would be to build this long chain of consecutive days of meditation without breaking that specific chain. Now, the only way that you can do that is by tracking and making sure that you're watching and building out this chain. That's the only way that you can make sure that that happens. But that's a super simplified version. I can't do justice to what's in the actual book. It's very simple, yet profound, the way he lays it out in the book.
Well, and one of the concepts in there that has really been a shift for me and with our coaching clients and even my peers is the question of, did you do your best on a scale of 1 to 10 with this important action? Rate the effort that you gave, and having to report on effort and acknowledging. And, you know, mine for a while has been yoga, and 3 times a week for 20 minutes. So lame. Like, why can't I not get 3 times a week, 20 minutes of yoga in? But having to go into my peer group every week and say, yeah, this week I didn't, it was a 4. Like, you know, I had to be honest with myself. I wasn't doing my best. And then that moment when we are confronted with, I'm saying this is important to me, and for some reason I'm not doing my best. What is that about?
Yeah, that's a very, what that underlying thing is, if that can be uncovered, that is the key. And that's the thing that we all have to learn to look for.
Yeah. So when it comes to measuring performance on your team, Wayne, and creating a high performance culture, I'm assuming you're measuring performance, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
So what do you measure?
Yeah. So just like with so many things in life, there's these kind of dichotomies or opposing forces. So for example, if our sole focus is on measuring revenue, the flip side of that is we could drive revenue, but at the same time, we could really have terrible customer service, right? Because we're so focused on revenue. And then the flip side of that would be if we're solely focused on providing remarkable customer service, our revenue, our profit in that scenario could be hurt the opposite way. And so what we try to do with all performance is we try to ensure that for every single role in the company, that there is a balance between those kind of opposing forces. And it's not always just with revenue, profit versus other things, but those are the obvious ones that you can look at. So the way that this plays out, the way that we measure performance starts again, jumping all the way back to the vision, is where are we trying to go? So once we know where we're trying to go as a company, we then have a vision for each individual department within the company. Now, it's my responsibility as a leader to paint the picture, to build the vision for the company as a whole. So where do we want to end up in 3 years? Based on that, now we use that in the hiring process as well, because we don't want anyone on our team that doesn't believe in and buy into the vision that's set for the company. So, you know, that's kind of foundational. The next thing is we have kind of department heads within the company. So, you know, we've got somebody that runs the website side, the social media side, the marketing side, et cetera. Now, for each of them, it's their responsibility to create a vision for their specific department. And so their vision, they can't just, you know, sit down and craft whatever they want, because their vision has to fit within the vision that's been painted or drawn out for the company itself. And that's why it's so important to have that very early on in the hiring conversations, because when you're bringing somebody in at that level, so a department head kind of level, you want to make sure that they understand where you're going as a company and how they can help contribute based on the department that they're going to lead. Now, there are two different ways here that we measure performance. One of them, we started with a book called The Game of Work by Chuck Kuhnrent. And Chuck is kind of known as the godfather or grandfather of gamification in workplace setting. And in that, he lays out this thing called the field of play. And so if you just think of basically a football field, that's pretty much what it is. On either side of the field, left and right hand side of the field, you've got out of bounds, right? So if somebody goes out of bounds on the left side of the field, we would call that terminal out of bounds. So terminal out of bounds simply means that that is something that if you out of bounds on this side of the field, you're probably going to be terminated. So those would be, you know, stealing, lying, cheating. You know, we've got a list of those things. Every company should have a list of those things. On the other side of the field, we have what are called operational out of bounds. So operational out of bounds are things that are more, you know, infractions, I guess would be the word. So you're out of bounds, you're not out of the game, you're going to come back into the game, but you're going to get a warning. Hey, you stepped out of bounds here. Here's how you stepped out of bounds, here's why you stepped out of bounds, et cetera. Now, for our operational out of bounds, we have a document that is called the Ugly Mug Expectation Guide. And this document outlines all of the expectations that we have for team members on our team. And again, this goes all the way back to hiring, but that document gets shown to applicants in the hiring process. So if you make it through kind of the first rounds of hiring, you're going to get a copy of that document. We're going to ask you to review that document. And to ensure, we're going to ask you, is there anything in this document that you would not be willing to agree to and live up to? So it goes all the way back to hiring. But then there's the end zone in the field, right? So on the kind of the top end of the field, there's the end zone. And that is where we want the employees to get to. So we start at one end of the field, which, you know, would be the bottom of the field, and we're working our way up to the end zone. In the book, Chuck identifies what he calls RRRs, which are results to resources ratio. Now, that works really well if you're doing things like manufacturing. We all, you know, what we kind of produce here are ideas and execute around those ideas. So results to resources ratio didn't really work well for us. So we began looking at another kind of goal setting or performance measurement system called OKRs, objectives and key results. And again, this comes from a great book called Measure What Matters by John Doerr. I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name. He was one of the first investors in Google. So his goal setting system is based on objectives and key results. So on that field of play, each team member establishes three core goals or three core objectives that they're going to aim for in the upcoming quarter. So one of those is typically a revenue or profit goal. The next one is some form of fulfillment or service goal. So in other words, exceeding customer expectations. And then the other one is typically some form of future work goal. And what I mean by future work is not anything to do with any current projects that we may be working on. This would be things that specifically are designed to drive future growth for their division that they work in. So that's the long version to say this. What happens is every single quarter, each team member fills out this field of play, and they establish these three core goals. And then what we do is every single week in our team meeting, which takes place every single Monday afternoon, 1:45 to 3 o'clock every single Monday, whether I'm in the office, I'm not in the office, and let me just clarify what I mean by that. The only reason I would not be here for that meeting is if I'm on vacation.
Good for you, Wayne. It's all about taking vacation and the business can run without you. There you go.
Yeah. So the meeting takes place every single Monday and it's mandatory. And again, unless someone's out on vacation or sick, it's a mandatory meeting. You cannot have any other meetings during that time. During that meeting, each team member has to report on the actions that they took to drive each specific goal. So they've got those three goals. They have to report on the actions that they took to drive that goal forward. And then they also present the actions they're gonna take over the next week to drive each of those goals forward. So it creates a real sense of peer-to-peer accountability because no one wants to get up every single week and say, you know what, my goal was this, my three actions were this, and I did zero of those. And so that framework, that structure alone has radically transformed the way that performance takes place inside our company.
That's huge. Yeah. So is that the only meeting that you have is a weekly meeting or are there other meetings?
Yeah. So we have a weekly team meeting every single Monday. And that is, again, it's all of us together presenting goals up on a screen so everybody can see what was done or not done. And then every single Tuesday, we do one-on-ones. And so Tuesday is literally where I sit down one-on-one with each leader on the team and we talk through what are the issues that you're facing, what are the challenges that you're facing, you know, what are the stumbling blocks that are preventing you or hindering you from taking the action that you need to take to ensure that you reach your goals. And the other meetings that we do would be quarterly. So quarterly, we have two different meetings. We have a kind of a preview. So what are the things that you're going to focus on for the next quarter? And then we have a separate meeting, which is a review. So at the end of the quarter, what did you accomplish? What did you not accomplish? What went well? What did not go well?
Wow. So there is, I hear in everything you're describing, there is strong accountability. There's goal setting and there's check back in and reporting and there's the opportunity to ask for help, to bring up challenges. So there's no open loops.
And how long did it take you to really get this system in place and get everybody on board and make it part of your culture?
10 plus years. It is an ongoing process and an ongoing evolution. And one of my favorite sayings, and I don't know where this comes from, but if the rate of change in your business is slower than the rate of change outside of your business, it won't be long before you're out of business. So I'll say that one more time. If the rate of change in your business is slower than the rate of change outside of your business, it won't be long before you're out of business. And so I use that phrase all the time with the team. We are constantly tweaking. We're constantly adjusting and fine-tuning what we do. You know, perfect example of that was we started initially trying to use RRRs, results to resources ratio. Didn't work. We shifted into OKRs, objectives and key results. And now we're kind of using a hybrid version based on just more traditional goal setting with task under those goals. So we're always adjusting. We're always tweaking. And again, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is build a culture here that is kind of self-accountable, where it's not always me having to look in and say, okay, you know, why aren't you doing X, Y, or Z, or why aren't you, you know, doing this or that? Instead, they're able to manage themselves and they're able to hold each other accountable on a peer-to-peer basis.
Now, I know that you also have incorporated 12-week years into your goal setting. Can you speak some about how that plays in here?
Sure. So OKRs, which was outlined by in the book Measure What Matters by John Doerr, he details in a lot of, he goes through a lot of examples and case studies of how they use objectives and key results on a quarterly system. And what we discovered going through and implementing that system and structure was that when we would set the objectives and then we would establish these key results that we were going to go after, oftentimes we would complete 100% of the key results, and yet we still would not achieve the objective that we set out to do. And so it just wasn't working out exactly for us. And kind of in hindsight, looking back, what he outlines in that book has a lot to do with large teams. So we're talking, you know, teams of hundreds of people and how they each have various components that all then feed into that one big objective. So for us, we're a small team. And what we discovered was we needed something that would more closely align the actual task or the key results being done to ensure that they resulted in the outcome of the goal or the objective. And so there's a book out there called The 12-Week Year. And I believe the author is Brian Moran, I believe his name. And it's basically the same concept as objectives and key results, but broken into a framework that I believe is more suitable for small businesses. And what it basically says is this, that when you set goals for like a year period, it's so far in the future that what happens is we delay and we put off until it's too late to make enough progress towards that goal to actually reach it by the end of the year. So what he talks about is that you should treat every 12-week period as if it's its own standalone year. And so the question then becomes, what can we push to accomplish in the next 12 weeks, in the next quarter? What can we push to accomplish, you know, for the company, for the division, for each individual? And so for us, what it does is it breaks that down into very measurable, short periods of, you know, hard work and lots of effort so that we can then see the fruits of those much more quickly, as opposed to kind of this longer, big, you know, longer term picture.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, that's so true what you said about that we will just put something off and we'll say, I'll get to it later. And the bringing it very close into the present, and we have to look at what are the actions we need to take. It's very powerful. Mike, you were jumping in there.
What I was going to say, yeah, I mean, well, it is extremely powerful. And I feel like this can be like a 20 podcast like topic here, because it's tremendous and everything that you're sharing. One question I do have quickly is, when you experience friction, how do you handle it? So when you know, either the reporting process, your team meetings, when you're experiencing any friction from your team or the results aren't there, yeah, I mean, basically, how do you attack it? What's your approach to get things right-sided again and just push in the right direction?
Sure. Yep. So one of the things that I think is so important for entrepreneurs to remember is that conflict within a company is not always a bad thing. And actually, it can be quite healthy. So in Patrick Lencioni's book, The 5 Dysfunctions of Team, which, by the way, it's probably one of my top 10 books. You know, I love that book and kind of the concepts of that book. But he talks a lot about the importance of conflict and why conflict matters. And the quick version of it is this. If I, as a leader, just come in here and say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're rolling forward with this. And everyone in on the team just nods their heads and says, okay, yeah, whatever, here we go. And in the back of their minds, they're thinking, you know, this will never work. This is stupid. You know, we should be doing X or Y or Z. What's going to happen is they're going to just nod yes to pacify me and to say, okay, we're going to move forward. And so one of the things that's so important is that as it relates to friction and conflict, you want to encourage healthy conflict within your company. And so I never want it to be that I sit in a team meeting and I say, here's what we're going to do. And everyone just nods along in agreement. I want there to be people on the team who challenge me, who say, you know what? I hear what you're saying, but what about this? Or what about in light of the fact that we tried X, Y, or Z in the past, what has to happen? And so I think it's important that we don't run from conflict, that we embrace conflict, but we nurture healthy conflict, and that we give our team members the authority and the permission to challenge us as leaders, as entrepreneurs. And obviously there has to be structure and framework around that. But as it relates to, you know, just general friction with reaching goals and accountability and things like that, what I would say is it goes back to the buy-in to the vision, the mission, and the values. Because at the end of the day, no one ends up, you know, working at Ugly Mug or really at any company without kind of understanding what they're getting into. So as an entrepreneur, it's your responsibility to be upfront and transparent at the very, very beginning of the process about your expectations, your core values, what it is that you expect of them. So one of the things that I do is I actually encourage people that we're hiring or in the process of hiring, I encourage them to actually call previous employees who worked here and ask them what was the worst parts about working at Ugly Mug Marketing. Because I don't want to sugarcoat that, you know, this is the perfect world and that there's no stress and there's no issues with our culture. But I want them to know going in what the truth is, because, you know, from a potential employee's perspective, they would assume that I'm sugarcoating everything about the company because I want to make it look great and I'm trying to persuade them, because often, you know, the goal is we're trying to hire A players. But I want them to know the truth up front. And when they know that up front, when they buy into the vision, the mission, and the values, it makes those friction conversations that much easier because they know what they've agreed to, they know what they've committed to. And at the end of the day, I know that I'm not being the bad guy. I am here to help develop them, help challenge them, and push them not only to be better in their job, but to be a better person in life in general. And, you know, one of the things that we often talk about as a company here is that you grow the most when there's good stress on you. It's just like running or weightlifting or any of those physical activities. You're not going to grow. You're not going to develop if you're not increasing the weight, if you're not trying to increase your pace when you're running, if you're not trying to increase your distance. And so when we end up dealing with some stressful situations, some stressful projects, or some stressful clients, I try to remind the team that, look, I understand how frustrating this project is, or maybe this client that we're dealing with is right now. But here's the thing. In hindsight, when you look back on this, you will have learned and grown more as a result of this than all the clients or all the projects that are easy and go perfectly according to plan. So as it relates to friction, that's a super long answer, I realize. But as it relates to friction, I think it's important to realize that friction often creates the growth that we need, one, as leaders, and two, as a team.
That is such a great way to frame that, Wayne. And I think, you know, it's the tough things that we go through that make us stronger. And when you have embedded learning and coaching into your culture and that reflection of, okay, this was hard. What did we learn from it? And how can we be better because we've been through this? That's powerful. So I know we're almost at the end of our time, but I just can't help but ask you this final question. And that is, we are in a fairly small town. Some people who might be in New Jersey, for example, like Mike, might say we're in a more rural area. What are your strategies for attracting A players to Ugly Mug?
I would say that number one, it's the realization that there are different types of players, potential employees out there. And, you know, I would say that your book kind of influenced me several years back, you know, when we first originally met, around that mentality. I remember hearing years and years ago in a book that I read that during the startup phase of any business, that you should pay steak and eat hot dogs. And so his whole mentality was that you should be paying your team members as you're building your team out enough that they're going out for steak dinners. But if that means that you as the entrepreneur have to eat hot dogs, that's okay. And what I would say is, believe it or not, I have found that to be true. The times that I have hired A players, which we attempt to do every single time, but they're often very expensive, right? And what's interesting is my mentality used to be that how could I afford this expense, right? So here's what they want to make. Here's the salary that they're requesting. How can we afford this expense? And what I've learned over the years is it's not an expense when it's an A player. It's an investment.
Yes.
It is an investment. And that mentality shift or that mental shift for me was huge shift for me. And so that is one step in that process of attracting A players is the mentality shift from an expense to an investment. So the interesting thing about our team right now, so there are seven of us in office, eight of us when you include a couple of part-time people, but in the office, we have someone from Pennsylvania, we have someone from Michigan, we have another person from Florida, and they've all ended up here for various reasons. I'm not going to say that Ugly Mug was the reason that all these people ended up here, but what's interesting about A players, and Sabrina, I know you talk a lot about this, is they tend to congregate in the same circles. And so it's important to look within those same circles. Now, what we've discovered is those circles aren't necessarily the same circles. So in other words, the players on our team didn't know each other before coming here, but the circles that they operated in or they lived in were similar. So in other words, they had similar traits across all of these various circles that they lived in. The other thing I would say is just that our hiring process is somewhat, we give people lots of hoops to jump through. You know, our ratio I'd say right now is this: for every 50 applicants that we get, we will end up doing probably somewhere between 5 and 10 phone interviews. Of those 5 or 10 phone interviews, we will probably end up with 2, maybe 3 in-person interviews. And of those 2 to 3 in-person interviews, we may hire one person. That would probably be our ratio. And so, you know, for us, it's embracing the fact that we have to mine and go through a lot of applicants to find the gold. And it is a process. But we treat it as that. So we are constantly looking to hire. Even if we don't have a position available right now, we are always looking to hire because I would love to build a database of A players so that when positions do come available, we can go to that list and say, hey, I know that when you applied, we didn't have a position available, but now here's what we've got. You know, if it's interesting to you, let's talk.
Yes. Always be recruiting. Yeah. You said, I want to go back to the A players and their networks. And you're so spot on in that description. A players hang together. And what are the characteristics in the networks that you're identifying that are working for Ugly Mug?
Sure. Yep. So one of the things that we've identified is that A players are typically very involved in extracurricular activities. So for us, that's a pattern that we've noticed. They're involved, whether it's in civic organizations, church organizations, they're involved in those organizations, and they're typically in some form of leadership. Now, that doesn't mean that they're like leading these organizations, but they have some form of leadership role, whether it's, you know, they're helping organize events for it, whether they're kind of leading small groups, whatever it may be. That is one. The other one that we've identified, and it could just happen to be that, you know, my passion for books, but they typically are readers outside of work. So in other words, typically we find that these people are reading things that are, you know, there to help them. So self-improvement, spiritual growth, business growth, those types of things. They're reading those things without, you know, an employer or, you know, someone else telling them they need to read these things. So those would be a couple of the traits. And then the other one that I would say, and this one's a lot more difficult to measure and identify, is grit.
Yes.
That is another one that we've noticed is a common trait, but it's very difficult to measure on the front end.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the grit piece, that ability to encounter a problem and stick with it and work through it and not back down. I actually think that is a defining quality of A players.
Yeah, no, it has come up time and time again, just in terms of, you know, because as an entrepreneur, you get to see A players, you get to see B players, and you get to see C players, unfortunately, sometimes on your team. And so you get to observe kind of from an outside perspective, what are the traits, what are the characteristics of these various people? And you just look for those patterns. And I completely agree that grit is definitely a big one.
Yeah. Yeah. So Wayne, this has been a very enlightening discussion. I have a feeling this is going to be one of the episodes that our profit designers say, I'm listening to that one 3 or 4 times because there's so much here that you've shared with us. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us this morning. How can our profit designers get in touch with you? And if they would like to work with your company, Ugly Mug, what should they do?
Sure. You can reach me. You can find me at uglymugmarketing.com. All of our contact information is there on the site. And that's probably the easiest, the best way to get in contact. And again, I just want to say thank you all both so much for the opportunity to come and share. There's, again, nothing I love more than visiting with other entrepreneurs who are passionate about business, passionate about their teams, and passionate about growth. So thank you both so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for spending time with us today. Join our conversation in the Entrepreneurs Take Your Life Back Facebook community at tapthepotential.com/group. Share your aha moments from today's episode, ask me questions, and join in on the fun with your fellow entrepreneurs on the journey to designing sustainably profitable businesses that give you more time for what matters most and more money in your bank account than ever. And finally, share today's episode with a friend if you know a friend who would enjoy it. This is real life business. Keep your chin up. Keep moving forward. You got this. If you're loving the Profit by Design podcast and have gotten any value out of it for your business or your life, would you mind doing 2 things? Subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. And please leave us a review. Our listener reviews help us get into the top 10 of all entrepreneurship podcasts so that more entrepreneurs like you discover us. Your review is critical in helping us make a difference for more entrepreneurs who are ready to take their life back.